But just calling it out, I think, is the most important thing. And that's going to help all of us from getting fired as a professional. Just call the elephant, and move on.
Taking notes.
The heart of advice. It's personal. It's pragmatic. Here on the eMoney Heart of Advice podcast, we explore how to navigate both sides to help you take your financial planning practice to the next level. Join us as we speak with financial professionals to learn how they deepen relationships and improve client outcomes. This podcast contains purely educational information, and nothing discussed may be construed as legal, tax, or financial advice. Please consult a financial advisor for any financial investment or money management questions. All views or opinions represented are solely the opinion of the speaker and do not represent those of eMoney Advisor or any of its affiliates or subsidiaries.
Welcome to the eMoney Heart of Advice podcast. In each episode, you'll hear eMoney experts talk with real advisors and researchers about planning for their clients.
eMoney is a market-leading provider of financial planning solutions, and we are trying to do our part to help empower financial planners to help deepen relationships and help people talk about money, starting with this podcast. I'm Connor Sung, certified financial planner and director of eMoney's Financial Planning Group, where I help clients build successful practices and deepen client relationships.
And I'm Sasha Gramsitter. I'm a senior financial planning education consultant with eMoney, where I support our company's financial planning education programs. So today on the podcast, we have not one, but two esteemed guests. So please let me introduce to you first, Dr. Sonia Luter. Dr. Sonia Luter is a certified financial planner. She's also a licensed marriage and family therapist. She conducts research on the relational dynamics of financial planning. She's also the director of financial health and wellness and master's program at Texas Tech University, and the owner of Enlight, a research and training consultancy firm. On the other side, we have Dr. Michael Kotakoda. He's a certified financial planner as well. He's the CEO of Wolfbridge Wealth. He conducts research on financial planning outcomes and a lecturer at Columbia University. So, Sonia and Mike, we are so excited to have you on. Could you just introduce yourselves and tell everyone a little bit about how you got here and what your focus is on and what you love to do today?
Sure. I'll start. Thanks, Sasha and Connor. This is really fun to be with you, and it's great to have four people on the podcast. So I got into this area by accident, which is very common with everybody else. But essentially, I went into therapy after studying personal financial planning, thinking I had no idea what I was going to talk about with couples if they started fighting or crying in my office. So that's how I got into the therapy side of things, but that opened up a whole new window that I was not prepared for in terms of other issues that were going on for couples in particular and families in general, and really just thinking through the commonalities among all of the things that families are struggling with. And that's really led me on a current pathway of identifying core values and how this is influencing how couples and families interact with each other within the same generation and then across generations. And this more broadly feeds into the area of financial health and wellness. So it's really fun to lead that curriculum at Texas Tech University and help financial planners understand how to apply this in practice. And if you cannot see the video that we are recording, we're getting lots of guns up from Sasha over there with Texas Tech. So go ahead and throw your guns up if you're affiliated in some way.
Mike, we'd love to hear from you.
I'll go. Yes. I guess next and last. So I don't have an affiliation with Texas Tech other than I know Sasha and Sonia.
You can do guns up anyway. It's all right.
Why not? I actually got into the therapy side and the heart advice of advice from working with couples going through divorce. Specifically, most of my training in that area had to do with a lot of nonviolent communication, using the getting to yes negotiation model to facilitate getting to a resolution. So it's less on the side of, you know, an intact marriage where people are trying to, you know, resolve differences, but more on the side of how do you move forward as your family evolves to this separate sort of lifestyle. I've been doing that for about 20 years, and it is certainly a learning experience where you emotionally engage with clients and you deal with the crying that occurs in the room and the little bit of the yelling and the arguments too. So you get to see what works, what doesn't work. It's how I've grown my practice and how I work with most people.
Well, like I said, we're excited to have both of you on. I know when we were having this discussion about bringing Dr. Michael Cote Dakota on, he actually suggested that Dr. Luder come on with him as well, because they're, you know, they have very similar research interests, but they're also very separate. So I think that's what we're going to dive into today, and I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, just to start us off, you know, some of the e-money research will prove that very few financial advisors actually feel comfortable having any like real difficult topic discussions outside of, you know, their subject matter expertise, which is more around the, what I'd say, traditional financial planning. That number is 8% of financial advisors said that they felt comfortable dealing with many of these topics, one of which is conflict inside of the household. And ultimately, those clients, it's 1 in 5 couples that are saying that money is the biggest relationship challenge that they have inside the household. We cover quite a bit of that in eMoney's Candid Conversations Guide, but obviously I'd love to jump in there. And Sonia, you know, why is it, do you think, that so many couples, even ones that have resources, knowledge, experience, maybe some, you know, actual building of their own plans or investments, do you have any insights or conclusions from your research that kind of shows why?
I love the research that you all have that's coming out. And I'll also say that some of it's not new. We knew this information before. So 15 years ago is really when I started this research track of why is it that couples are arguing about money and what's the influence this is having on their relationships. And what I found, this has been my most interesting research finding to date, is that the amount that a couple argues about money early in their relationship is more predictive of relationship satisfaction down the road than an increase in arguments or how frequently they're arguing about money down the road. And I think that is extremely telling to everything that you're saying, is that if we can't get on the same page in those early years, it's going to continue to compound over the years, over the decades, and only get worse and worse as time goes by. And why is that the case? I think it's very clearly a reflection of values and how we're spending our money. I love what you said, Connor, with resources being more broad than money, because there's a lot of ways that we can look at those resources and how we're spending our time and contributing to the household financial situation. Another one of the really impactful research findings, I think, given my situation, hopefully other people can relate to this as well, is that even today in 2024, when a woman makes more than her husband, there is an increase in arguments about money. And then furthermore, it is wild. And when a woman makes more than her husband, she actually contributes more to household labor than the husband. So in terms of those resources, we're looking at presumably some sort of gender dynamic going on, right? That when the woman's making more than her husband, they're increasing their arguments about money, maybe because of this misalignment with what they were expecting in that relationship. But then it also seems to go pointing the finger at the female a bit in this situation, that if she's making more, she's also maybe feeling guilty about that and therefore doing even more household work than what you would predict from a purely economical standpoint of time constraints and who can make more in the market versus who can specialize in the household. So I think there's a lot of really interesting things going on there. And if we don't have those conversations early in our relationship of what is our financial situation like right now, what are our time constraints right now, and what if that changes over time? Are we going to switch up how we think about our situation, and how do we know when to do that? So all of this comes back around to, we've got to have the money conversations, and it's such a hard conversation to have. Clearly, we're all working professionals, and we're tired at the end of the day. We were just talking earlier about Mondays are not a good day to record podcasts because we're coming off of the weekend and so whatnot. I totally agree. But then at the end of the week, it's no better for having a conversation with our significant other about money because we're tired from the work week. And so it's this effort we have to put into just starting the conversation and making it a priority for our relationship so that we don't have to have the exact same values, but we need to understand what each other's values are and continue to have that conversation on a regular basis because our opinions can change and our situation can change. And so having that regularly scheduled time is so critical.
I guess I could jump in and say I couldn't agree more. I think that having conversations, and I think that's when you do work with couples, so often you'll see, even when they're not getting divorced, you'll see that it's just that the conversation just doesn't really occur, or they need a facilitator, somebody to help them not talk past each other, because sometimes like the obvious symptom is not the symptom. You just can kind of notice that something's not happening. And I think a lot of that boils down to depletion. So Zanya was talking about the end of the day, you don't feel like talking about it, or, you know, Monday after daylight savings time or Friday, anytime is bad, quite frankly, because we're depleted and we make poor decisions. We tend to not be as understanding and we tend to not explain ourselves as well. When we are in that depleted state.
I like what you said, though, at the beginning, to where you don't have to be specially trained necessarily to start this conversation or to be that facilitator, because there's a difference between doing therapy or being a financial therapist even and communicating therapeutically. And this is one of the things that our field struggles with deeply, is feeling like there's some sort of boundary of communicating therapeutically. And really, that communicating therapeutically, it means being present with that person in that conversation, listening without bias, and providing reflective feedback for them. You don't need to be solving anything for them. You just need to be, quote unquote, a friend and listen carefully and guide that conversation from a third perspective that it's oftentimes very hard to see in the moment.
That's scary, though.
It is scary because you might cross into some boundary.
I don't know. I go back. So Seisha's an accredited financial counselor. That curriculum has some of those techniques that allow you to be present and communicate in a way that is not crossing the line. You know, if you can give financial advice, but communicate, you can communicate financial advice therapeutically, I think is probably the best way to look at it. You don't have to be a therapist. You just communicate the advice you're giving in a therapeutic way. I like that, communicating therapeutically. That's a great way to say it.
It raises a good question. And I started off talking about the 8% of FAs that are comfortable having some of these more difficult conversations. So clearly it's not a strong suit for most. And they're shying away from it, regardless of what I think a lot are scared of what could happen if they ask some of these questions or where they'll head outside of where they feel comfortable. Maybe they're in their own financial lives or in just their own lives in general. Mike, with both, financial psychology has been incorporated into a whole bunch of curriculum, right? Most notably, most recently into the CFP curriculum. Like, how do you think we start to change the next generation of financial planners by creating this foundation of training them with financial psychology?
Well, I think the next generation they're probably already primed for that. These younger generations tend to be a little bit more open with their emotions. They tend to be, you know, more available. They're thinking about, you know, how other people feel. When they have conversations, they tend to be a little bit more thoughtful about those sorts of things. So hopefully, you know, it'll be a natural progression. They'll just kind of fit right into it. The other thing I think, you know, I think at, as faculty members, we need to be making sure that, you know, psychology of financial planning is not a subject area. It permeates all of the profession.
Yeah.
And so it's not just like, you're going to learn this and then that's one aspect. It's not, it's in everything. And I think if you are, you know, if you're an instructor, you know, it's incumbent upon you to reiterate these points. And one of the things that I always tell students is, I talk about it usually in the context of the potential for high pay. You know, this is, can be a very highly paid profession. But I tell people they have to be technically competent. And technical competence can also include, you know, making sure you understand the psychology of financial planning. But you need to be emotionally intelligent. You need to be able to read your clients. You need to be able to communicate to them, and you need to be able to help them with their emotions. So those are already that I just added something that we haven't been doing for the last 50 years, or at least 92% of people haven't been doing for the last 50 years. And then you also have to be able to communicate your value, because this isn't a field where it's known that you need this, right? That people need this sort of help. And so those are three very difficult things. And in many cases are highly paid just individually. And the very fact that you have to, as a financial planner, you have to be able to do all three. I mean, that's what it means to be. And so I think, you know, impressing upon the next generation the importance of these tasks, I think is a big part of how we change the profession for the better.
I don't disagree that the next generation is more prepared, but I would give some credit also to maybe some of the more mature or long-term financial planners, because at Texas Tech, within the curriculum, there's a fair number of people who have been practicing for 20 or 30 years and feel like they're missing something, and they've found their way into health and wellness or psychology of financial planning or financial therapy.
We know, you know, Ron Sages, for example. I mean, I think there's plenty of people who are older who have this this mindset, or, you know, they know this is missing. And some people are doing these things naturally and they just don't know. They haven't figured out a way to formalize it. You know, they've had to learn. I mean, I was one of those people who thought, well, you only needed to know this number stuff. That's all you needed to know. You didn't need to know anything else. And my career really took off when I embraced this part, which is probably another way to reach folks. But yeah, it took me a while.
I just want to say that, you know, one of the reasons I became a financial counselor was because of the piece I felt like was missing. I understood the technical piece, but I really wanted to know the emotions and that piece of clients. So it's kind of why I went in that direction, to be honest. But I wanted to kind of segue into our next question. And Sonia, this is really for you. What circumstances commonly result in advisors kind of being fired by their married clients in their early years of marriage? I'd love to hear this, especially for Connor, as he's getting married very soon. So we have to, you know, prep Connor and get him ready.
Thank you.
Oh, there's so much to cover for you, Connor. But here's what it all boils down to. And it's easier said than done. I recognize that. And this is one of my mentors when I was in therapy school. And he would say every single day, multiple times per day, we would have constant supervision. Like, he would be watching me do therapy with clients, and then the feedback would come right after that. Or sometimes they would even call into the room and be like, we need to take a break. And he would call us out. And one of the things that he would always say was, make the covert overt. In other words, make what's not being said. And say the obvious. And I think that really is where couples run into problems, and where financial advisors run into problems, is that they recognize that their couples that they're working with are not on the same page, and yet they don't say anything about it because they don't feel qualified, or they feel like that's crossing some sort of boundary. And that in and of itself is where the problem arises, is that we're all just pretending like the elephant's not there. Let's just call the elephant an elephant and be done with it. Like, if I'm going to call the elephant an elephant and then say, but I don't know how to fix your elephant or get the elephant out of the room, that's fine. But at least you are making the obvious known and helping that couple get on the pathway that they need to go for whatever the future of their relationship is. And some relationships won't last. And that's the reality of the situation, right? But if you ignore that conflict or emotional misalignment that you're seeing, you're probably going to get fired because you're not addressing the real problem that's in front of you. And going back to the last question, just for a quick second, with this new curriculum in psychology of financial planning, I think one of the things we tend to overlook as financial professionals is that we're over here in the professional seat, but psychology of financial planning is about understanding the mind as it relates to the financial situation of financial planning, which is not psychology of the client or client psychology. It's the interaction between me, the professional, and the client, and how my biases and behaviors are influencing what's going on with the client and how I'm interpreting what the client says. And so I think all of this in terms of getting fired is us not recognizing the impact that we're having on the clients. And whether that's us placing our biases onto the client and saying they should save for retirement, maybe that's nowhere on their radar. Like, they want to work until the day that they die. And if you don't pause and reflect upon that and have a conversation about that, you're going to lose them as a client because you're not communicating in the language that they are listening to. The same thing goes if they're having a conflict and you recognize that they come in 1 week, totally different nonverbal communication, and they're not interacting with each other as a couple the same way that they were a month ago. We can all see that. We don't need to be a therapist to see when a couple is not getting along, right? Like, we're going to dinner with a couple and, oh, something's wrong with them. Like, it's obvious. And so making that known of, I see that something else must be on your mind. Is that something you want to discuss right now? Or is that something you all are discussing elsewhere? That's fine. And if they lead into a vomiting of what's going on and you're not prepared, you'd be like, okay, it sounds like you have a lot going on. This is certainly beyond the scope of what I can offer. Do you want me to help you find somebody else who is appropriate for talking about those issues? Or do you already have someone? But just calling it out, I think, is the most important thing. And that's going to help all of us from getting fired as a professional and also keep us in that relationship, Connor. So remember that. Just call the elephant and move on.
Taking notes.
I just need to make sure I get some sort of mediator.
Yeah, that works too. And schedule the regular conversations.
Definitely. I think
that is important, the scheduling.
Mm-hmm. Forced conversations.
Yeah.
I think talked a little bit about, so, you know, obviously addressing the issue or addressing things that you can see here or that maybe you have seen or noticed. I think that probably, at least for me, gives me the most sense of angst or anxiety, like actually calling somebody out and saying, hey, something is off. And, you know, calling out makes it seem like it's a negative thing, but at least, again, making the covert overt. When faced with other ambivalence or bickering between clients during meetings, are there other strategies or techniques? Like, how do you actually facilitate a discussion like that to help with the decision-making process and promote progress as you go through a financial planning engagement?
Telling somebody that, you know, you're making me feel inadequate, you know, that's probably not the best way to approach it. Instead, might say something like, when you say this, I feel this way. And so that it's that shift of communicating, you know, accusatorily, or what we would say violent communication, right? Where it seems like you're feeling attacked. And so, you know, even things like when you're talking about if something bothers you, say we do this thing in collaborative divorce where we say, you know, have a request, which actually we've done that at home You know, I have a request that you put your dishes in the dishwasher. Our daughter does the same thing to this day, where it is a way of taking the temperature down so that you can have those more difficult conversations. You know, making sure that it's, you know, it's less about judgment. Not that there's not, I mean, people say, well, no judgment here, but there's always some judgment. You know, so that, but taking the temperature down so that, and that there's, you know, the ability to have those conversations that are difficult, to talk about the elephant, to, you know, make the covert overt, which is just a really fantastic way of getting the conversation going. So that's, I think, how you talk about things is incredibly important. That really will help. One of the other pieces, I think, if you're really trying to get people to, you know, care about a specific topic, a lot of times you'll have couples where, you know, one person will be doing all the talking, the other person will just kind of go along with it. And they may not really be going along with it, just going along with it because they're uncomfortable, or they don't want to be there, or they don't feel heard, whatever it might be. And so it's really easy for a financial planner to focus on the person who is communicating with them. And it's much more difficult to bring in somebody who, you know, doesn't appear to participate in the conversation. And so one thing to do is set expectations up front about everybody is, you know, this is a team effort. This isn't going to be just, you know, one or two of you or one of you talking to me. It's not going to be just me talking. It's going to be all of us having a conversation. And then including that person, especially as you start to feel the balance shift. Because the balance, I mean, it's not that people notice. It's just that they choose not to, financial planners will choose not to try to rebalance that. And it's really important to make sure that the other person is heard. And I can tell you, it's actually pretty easy in divorce because, you know, people will say something at that point. So you learn to balance pretty quickly. But I think being able to make sure that that person is included. And so, and it might be that you're just either you're speaking, you know, you're using jargon, which turns off, you know, a lot of people. I think the typical problem is that, the financial planner who's, you know, statistically likely to be male, is going to be, you know, connecting with the male participant if you assume a heterosexual couple. And then, so the woman is getting left out of the conversation, which is just crazy to me. You have to include that person in the conversation, and their needs have to be met. Otherwise, you're just going to foment more conflict.
Amen. Sorry, had to. Sonia, do you want to comment on the question?
Well, to that most recent point, I think it's also interesting to think about socialization around money. Even as children, we know that parents talk to their boys differently than they talk to their girls. And this leads to men who understand personal finance more naturally than women. And it's nobody's fault per se, besides for those conversations that they've already heard in life are different depending on their gender. And I think Mike's disagreeing with me over there. But
it's somebody's fault.
Maybe, you know, why are you placing judgment here, Mike? We're being non-judgmental. Adults get to where they are.
It's International Women's Month.
It is. Yay for women. So there is a difference, though, in knowledge and in confidence around money for adults based off of men and women. And I think it behooves us to not think about those socialization aspects and to encourage women to gain more confidence in personal financial matters. And this means communicating with them differently. And maybe there's a newsletter that goes out just to your female clients, or that's geared more towards women-oriented conversations, and really just helping them build some of that confidence that they maybe missed out on as children or didn't get as much of when they were children. And us as adults, we can start communicating with our children differently around money and having the same conversations with our boys and our girls so that we can shift some of that trajectory.
I really love that. I do have two boys. So for me, you know, those conversations around money started early, but I also had conversations about doing chores, and we have like a mini chef night. So the boys have to learn how to like do some things in the kitchen. So we're, trying to diversify those conversations in my household, at least. One of the next questions that we have is really about when you're in a client meeting and they're just stonewalling you. How do you navigate those meetings?
Yeah. I wonder if people know what the word stonewalling means.
Oh, yeah.
And I should like define it. Maybe we should define that. I am a classic stonewaller. So when I am angry, I will shut you out and I am not going to communicate with you. And I'll show up physically, but mentally I'm not there and I don't want to engage in conversation. This is very common with couples to have one person who is just wanting to get it all out and the other person who's running away from that conversation. And so if you're sitting there and you've got the stonewaller client and then the really talkative client, it's easy to talk with the talkative client and ignore the stonewaller. They don't want to engage you. So let's just leave them be. And in fact, that's the exact opposite thing to do. So step one, make the covert overt and ask them what it is that's going on. And if they would like to express some of their frustrations or what's on their minds. The other thing that I think is really helpful when you're dealing with stonewalling is to give people alternative ways of communication. And we have ample opportunities now with the way that we interact with our clients digitally, and allowing them to submit information electronically before the meeting. So ask them for like responses to 5 questions, and then you can be the talker for them during that session, because that's going to give them the space to really think about what's on their mind and put that down on paper and in words. And so even if they don't feel like talking about it in that moment, at least you have some of the things that are going on in their mind that you can reference. We can do this through chat functions if we're using something like a video conferencing system to meet with our clients. Maybe they don't want to talk out loud, but they're willing to put a quick response in a chat, or if you put up a poll or something like that. This is going to require more work on your part, but allowing them to communicate in different ways, I think, is really helpful in allowing them the space to think and then respond later. And let's say you do all of that and they're still refusing to provide input. That's quite possible with a really extreme stonewaller. Mm-hmm. Not saying that I can relate, but maybe I can. And then what you can do is you can start talking for the stonewaller and be like, well, it seems like Sonia really feels this way about this. And then you start making a plan based off of that. And if I don't agree with you, I will stop you. And so I think that's a really nice strategy, is just to start talking for the stonewaller and putting their name in the sentence. And if they agree, then they'll let you continue on. But then you can be really extreme and put something that you know they will disagree with, and then they will respond and correct you.
Yeah. I like that tactic. That's a good way to get people talking who just really don't want to talk if you put something really incorrect in there. It sounds like you're saying, or it sounds like you're saying X is a really effective way to get that going.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You touched on it a little bit in there, Sonia, as far as different ways to facilitate discussions. In that example, specific to stonewalling behavior, but you got a little bit towards additional resources, and obviously eMoney being a technology company is near and dear to at least to our hearts. But Mike, as a user of eMoney specifically, and I'd ask just more broadly, from a technology and just from a facilitation standpoint, how can you use stuff like financial planning tech to help get couples on the same page?
Well, one thing is, especially when you've got technology with great visuals, which eMoney has a ton of great visuals, you can, people are both seeing the same thing, but you can also have conversations to make sure they're seeing the same thing. Walking through an explanation of what a balance sheet looks like, or what the cash flows look like over time, And then just sometimes what I'll do is I'll throw, talking about putting something in error, sometimes I'll throw errors in so that it will facilitate a conversation about a particular thing, particularly if it sounds like there may have been some conflict around that topic. You know, whether it's like a retirement account or, you know, somebody, you know, wanting to get a second home. So whether you're looking at, you know, the purchase of a second home or something, like what does that look like and how does that affect things? So putting errors in there usually will help, you know, so maybe somebody said they were looking at a, you know, $200,000, you know, mountain condo, and then you just put in like $500,000 one. That will create
making the covert that overt.
That is falsifying the overt. But what it will do is it will create that conversation. And if you can not be afraid of making mistakes, because a lot of people don't want to make any mistakes, but like that is an obvious, you know, sort of mistake. I don't tell them that I'm doing it on purpose, but that's one way. I do think also just having the portal where everybody can, you know, people can, you know, check and see what's, you know, what's going on. It will trigger conversations often.
We're really excited, obviously, about the new client portal that just released. I'm sure, Mike, that you've already seen it already, and the new features for clients to basically, you know, go through it. And it's a little more intuitive. It's a little more modern looking.
I was actually doing a screen share with a client last week when, you know, hey, this looks different. Well, they just changed it. So
you did.
Yeah.
Good feedback.
But she seemed pretty excited about it. I don't know how much that was me or how much that was the technology. For the purpose of this podcast, we'll say it's technology.
Thanks. Sonia, I was listening to you on another podcast recently, and it actually made me want to go figure out what my values were. And my husband's also a financial planner. So I was like, hey, go do this real quick, because I don't know if we've ever talked about our values. And so I just wanted to know how you help facilitate alignment on your core goals when you're working with couples. I would love to hear, mostly for my sake and Connor's sake, but just for like hearing about values and how to make that alignment happen.
Yeah. If you ask a person what their core values are, some people can rattle them off very quickly. They know the things that are most important to them: family, exercise, philanthropy, whatever. Some people, they'll just give you a blank stare. And those are the ones that are really challenging, because we got to start from the beginning and really identify, well, what is it that gives you meaning and purpose? And probably in the podcast, I was talking about my book called A Couple's Guide to Love and Money. And within that, there's an exercise where you go through and you, out of a pretty exhaustive list, circle the things that 10 things that are most important to you from this list. And then it narrows down to 5, and then it narrows down to 3. And then each partner is doing this separately, and then we come together and talk about each other's top 3 values. But then it gets to be challenging. How do we make a financial plan that aligns with those 6 values? Hopefully there's some sort of overlap because you're in this couple relationship,
hopefully.
But probably not all 6 values are going to align. So what I like to do with couples is figure out where our similarities are within those different sets of core values. And then let's make a bullseye. Like a literal bullseye. So if you're in an in-person meeting with clients and you can draw this out on a piece of paper or on a whiteboard, or video conferencing systems have some different templates that you can use for this as well. And you would start with the center circle. What is the thing that is most important that we both agree on? And we're going to put that as a label of in the center of our bullseye of family, let's say. And then we're going to go out, what's the second most important value? And maybe here's where we're going to start deviating a bit in terms of what you think is your second most important value, what I think is my second most important value. So we might have to have some conversation about what we want to put there. Or maybe it's something new that wasn't necessarily on either one of our list, but it identifies something that's important for both of us with that second core value. And then we keep going out in the rings. So maybe we'll have 6 rings. Maybe we'll have 3 rings. It's going to vary for everyone. And each of those rings is going to have a core value listed within the ring. And then what I would have them do on actual sticky notes is write down their financial goals. And again, you can do this digitally with different templates that are out there. And then we would write down whatever it is that their goals are. So maybe it's buy a new house. And then we're going to put that sticky note on the ring of the bullseye that identifies with the value. And if we can't identify where that financial goal aligns with one of those values, it doesn't line up very neatly with any of the rings, we'll still put it on the piece of paper, but it's going to be outside of the rings and we'll come back to it. And this really allows a couple to get on the same page of why it is that they're doing the things that they're doing with their money. If it's not something that aligns with my values, it's on the page, but it's not within the rings. Let's reprioritize, and maybe we can still work towards that goal, but let's address some of these other goals first and foremost. And I think it's a really nice visual aid when new ideas pop up, like whatever the newest fad is. Let's say your friends are into cryptocurrency and they're talking about it at the dinner party. You'd be like, oh, we should do that because we can make a lot of money doing that. Okay, well, let's go back to our picture and identify how would investing in cryptocurrency help us achieve one of these core values. And maybe one of your core values is adventure and innovation. Okay, then maybe it aligns and let's go forth with it. But if it's not clearly aligning with one of those core values, we can still put it on the page. Like, let's analyze what this investment would look like for us and why we want to invest in that. And then maybe we'll address it after we do the other things. Again, it goes back to, I'll be redundant with making the covert overt. Again, putting it out on actual paper, either physically paper or digitally in front of the couple, it really makes a huge difference. So if you have not tried doing something like that, I highly recommend it because it's very illuminating to see what it is that's most important to you right there in front of you. And that we can always point back to it of, okay, we already had this conversation and this is what you told me is important to you. And if you changed your mind and you have other things that are important to you, that's fine. But let's incorporate it into being in alignment together.
I think we're going to have to call this podcast making the covert, overt, covert. Yeah. So we'll get there. Mike, did you have anything?
Bring it in one more time.
Yes, one more time. Mike, did you have anything that, you know, especially from practice? And I know that your research interests also is in divorce and divorce planning. So I just wanted to ask, you know, from your perspective.
Well, I mean, I do think that, you know, values play such an important role. And I think that, you know, it's always about goals. You always hear financial planners talk about goals and, you know, goal, this goal, that goal. And that, that mismatch between goals and values is always kind of illuminating. And so when I have my first meeting with clients is really, it's usually just a conversation, just kind of exploring. And it's not meant to, you know, it's sort of a meandering sort of conversation with some, you know, a few structural questions. But then the idea is the second conversation is trying to get at their values. And the third meeting is usually goals. And then much, much later, you start talking about, you know, the financial solutions that, you know, kind of help fit all, you know, solve these issues, help them realize that realize their values. And I think that is, it's difficult to do because you're talking about a long lead time to, you know, converting a client. So mechanically it's not how we've been taught to prospect and convert clients historically. But it is, I can tell you from personal experience, it makes them incredibly sticky and loyal. And it's really interesting how much when you ask somebody about their values and when you ask them questions that are unexpected, how highly those people think of you. You know, you don't have to be an investment genius with a, you know, track record that is showing that you're beating the market for the last 20 years, which, you know, that's unlikely. You just have to care about the person, and you have to ask them genuine questions about their lives, and they will, you know, you create a connection, and they will, you know, they will be incredibly loyal, and then they'll also think very highly of you just for, you know, for thinking of those questions. So I don't think that it's, you know, if you're thinking long-term and you want to be in this business long-term, then that's the way to do it. You have to figure out what their values are. Doing it that way is a much more rich relationship, and it makes the job more enjoyable. And, you know, going back to the very beginning, we were talking about people who don't want to get involved in these conversations. If you want to enjoy your job a little bit more, this is another way to do that. You know, we're not meant to be, you know, disconnected from other people. So,
yeah, I think that the values exercise is important for everyone. I'd even recommend that all of the advisors that are listening go through it, because as you think about, Mike, and as you were just talking about how I make basically every decision in my life, not just financial decisions, all basically aligned towards my values at this point. So the way I engage with people, the way I engage with my clients, the way that I talked to people, the way that I help deliver advice, it all leads back to fulfilling some aspect of the values that I've defined as important to me. And again, I think understanding yourself to that degree and understanding what you get from each relationship will ultimately help you help your clients more defining their values. And then I think it gives advisors something to lean on in basically every choice discussion. Sonia, you brought up, you know, knee-jerk fad reactions to, you know, social topics. Mike, you're talking about, you know, ultimately making the right decision for the client, not always the right financial decision for the client, but it is the right combination of decisions for them. I want to take us a step back real quick. And it's something that I've been trying to put together in my own head. Honestly, I've also tried to visualize this crazy Venn diagram of terms. And Sonia, you talked about it a little bit at the beginning on defining different pieces of what I think all of us have generally just put in this bucket of financial psychology. We at eMoney, we use the term financial wellness as our kind of like broad term, but can you just give a little bit to everyone just to help define a little bit the way that you view this Venn diagram of overlapping circles, and maybe some don't touch at all, but like financial psychology, financial therapy, financial wellness, psychology of financial planning, behavioral finance. I think that there's a lot of, at least for me, I'll speak for myself, I am confused on where things overlap and where they don't. But if you have an easy way to help me learn a little bit more, it'd be great.
Yeah. You can actually look at what the meanings of some of these roots are. So psychology, study of the mind. And that's different from the root thera, which means to treat. And that in and of itself, we can kind of put two different buckets there. Anything psychology is, we just want to understand it. We don't need to do anything about it. We're just trying to figure it out. And anything therapy related, we're actually trying to do something about it. So there is some overlap there, because to do something, you need to understand a bit about it. So there's an overlap between anything psychology and then the therapy side of things. But then we look into, there's a lot of psychology. The CFP board has two different books with psychology in the name, client psychology and then psychology of financial planning. And I think that's a really huge differentiation, but we tend to use them interchangeably, to where client psychology is really pointing at what's wrong with the client. And I need to understand the client's mind as it relates to their situation. Whereas financial planning is the process of financial planning. And you can't have the financial planning process as defined by the CFP board without the planner and without the client. So it's that interaction between the two. But I tend to think of wellness as being a little bit broader and something that incorporates, we're not necessarily needing to know the why behind something or to treat something necessarily, but really trying to achieve this holistic wellness or living with purpose and finding security in what it is that we do on a day-to-day basis. I love Gallup's definition of well-being, and they look at it with five elements of well-being. So financial well-being being one, and then we have physical and community and career and social, I think, is the one that I missed there. And you can't have financial well-being if we're not doing well in our relationships. And that doesn't necessarily mean my partner or my spouse. That could mean my relationship with my children or my relationship with my parents. And I can't be happy in my job. I can't have career well-being if I'm suffering from a financial well-being perspective, because maybe I'm going to work just for the sake of the paycheck without really having that fulfillment with the work. And so it's really taking a step out of what is it that I'm doing and why am I doing it and what brings me happiness. I was on a podcast a while back and the host was talking about humankind and what that means. And I don't know if I didn't fact check this, but it sounded good. Humankind, K-I-N-D, is we are as humans designed to be kind. And I think that's what wellness is really all about, is finding kindness and happiness in all of those areas of our life. And it's not finding pathology or trying to fix anything. It's just being happy with where we are in those different areas. So you put me on the spot there, Connor, but that's my brief definition and where they overlap.
You know, I think the broader understanding, at least as far as when we're talking about financial planners, people who most of the people who use your product, those are financial planners. You know, they need to know the psychology of financial planning, which means they need to understand what's going on in these various topics. They don't necessarily need to do therapy. But maybe they do need to, you know, help, you know, change behavior. So that may be something that's important to them. So I think that it's just, it would be helpful if, somebody, came up with, you know, a rule book or something that everybody could follow and say that these are the terms and this is how they apply. But then you're going to get all the people who say, well, I disagree. So it's challenging. But I do think we'll work it out. It can be a little anxiety inducing when trying to figure out what those different terms are. I would say if you stick to the psychology of financial planning, understanding what's going on and in your role in the client planner relationship, that's really where you should focus. Don't try to be a behavioral finance expert. Don't try to be a financial therapist unless you want to be one. You know, don't try to do those things. Just understand your role in that process. And
I think that's great. And that would be kind of fun to have a definitional cheat sheet. But in the end, it doesn't really matter, as you said. And I forgot to mention the behavioral finance, and that's largely targeted towards clients are not rational enough to make decisions on their own. So let's design something to put in place to help them make the more rational decision. And the thing with all of these different areas is there's a time and place for all of them. We need all of it. So they can all go into the same plan or into the same conversation. Because there's a need for behavioral finance and there's a need for psychology of financial planning. There's a need for client psychology and financial therapy. So I don't know that anyone is more superior than the other. It's just understanding when to apply them in various scenarios. And when people ask me to come speak about behavioral finance, I'll say, sure, but I'm going to span it out a little bit broader and talk about psychology of financial planning. And I'll talk about how behavioral finance is a part of that, but it's not the solution for everything.
Yeah, to the point earlier, I think there's folks that are doing all of these things today. And I think part of the anxiety for me, at least, is like, oh, wow, like what do all of those things mean? And am I doing them correctly today? And I think at the end of the day, the actual definitions, as you both talked about, they don't really matter. As long as you have deep, engaging relationships with your client, they feel fulfilled, you feel fulfilled, and, you know, where you drop each bullet point underneath those head topics. I totally agree. I don't think it matters.
I was going to tease Connor that maybe he should have gone to Texas Tech and studied under, you know, the famous Dr. Luther.
It's not too late.
it is not too late. But that's all I was going to tease. Yeah. So as we get toward, you know, the end of the podcast, we ask all of our podcast guests the same question. And then you guys can kind of, I guess, you know, rumble over who goes first. We just want to know, how do you define the heart of advice when it comes to financial planning? I know it's probably going to incorporate a lot of things we already talked about, but just so we can get a good soundbite.
I'll go first. Even though I started the podcast, I'll finish the podcast first as well. So when I think of the heart of advice, I think about survival. And without a heart, we can't do anything. And I think that's really what we're talking about here, is if we ignore everything that we've discussed on the podcast today, then the plan is going to fail, or it's not going to be as successful as it could. And really just thinking about the life of the financial plan and why are we doing what we're doing? And it's what brings the clients happiness and purpose and aligning with their values. So I think you're on the right track and I love what you're doing. And it's a really fantastic name for a fantastic purpose.
So when I think about the heart of advice, I think, you know, we talk about financial planning as personal financial planning. And so when I think of the heart of advice, I think that it's personal. That it is not an economist's view of how people should plan their financial lives. It's not a psychologist's view of how people should plan their financial lives. We're not looking at, you know, the median financial planning client. We're looking at individuals who have specific values, specific needs, and unique circumstances. And we can apply all of those things to these unique circumstances. But when it really gets down to it, it is the individual, the couple, the family that you're serving. And to truly serve them, you have to have that connection. You have to have the ability to communicate what you can do for them based on what they need. And if you can't do that, if you are somebody who is trying to force your view on how people should run their financial lives, then you're in the wrong business. I think the heart of advice is the right way to think about personal financial planning.
Thank you. We think so too. So that's why we're doing this podcast.
Well, we appreciate y'all's time. Thank you so much for sharing all of your insights, experience, guidance, some facilitation techniques. And I guess most of all, I'll leave it with make sure that you bring the covert to becoming the overt. And
Thanks for bringing it back in there one more time.
Had to. Thank you so much for joining us and chatting. It was fun.
Thank you.
Till next time.
The Heart of Advice podcast is produced by eMoney Advisor, a leading provider of technology solutions and services that help people talk about money. Learn more at eMoneyAdvisor.com, where you can find additional resources for advisor success, including the Heart of Advice blog, as well as eBooks, CE webinars, and events.